Hello there, Watch Your Step. You are back in the minefield where we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas, negotiate the ethical and moral terrain of modern life. Weeks don't come much thornier than this one. We will attempt to do our best. Waleed Ali is my name, Scott Stevens, my co-host, Scott.
Yes, well, in little more than a week, the global response to the plight of hundreds of thousands of refugees has taken, well, rather a surprising turn.
In the countryside, in the cities, on land and at sea, with hundreds of thousands of people on the move, Europe's migrant crisis has brought countless stories of hardship and tragedy. But the fate of just one of those migrants has added urgency to the crisis. Off the coast of Turkey, two boats got into trouble. The strongest survived. The weakest were washed ashore. Three-year-old Aylan was one of them, his tiny body carried from the beach by a Turkish policeman.
After the reception centres, the refugees are taken to new living accommodation, like these student halls of residence outside Munich. Ahead lie daunting challenges, learning a new language, finding employment. But for now, they're simply happy to be in the country they have yearned for so long to reach.
What an incredible week of images, Scott. It begins, I suppose, with that iconic image, or that image that, if it's not already iconic, will become iconic, of a dead toddler washed up on the beach. And then after that, we see the influx of other images of an influx of people at train stations across Europe, of people holding up refugees' welcome signs, of really quite moving statements being made by leaders across Europe, offering their own houses even for refugees who would come from Syria. We have seen an unbelievable outpouring of welcome in Europe, in a way that I would suggest has actually been inspiring, but also a little self-congratulating. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that self-congratulating thing being there, except that it raises in my mind a very interesting question for us to explore. And that is, what happens after the welcome? What happens when the bloom is off the rose? What happens when the glow is gone? Because this will assuredly come. And it has already started coming. Indeed, one of the beneficiaries, you could argue, of this outpouring of welcome and compassion, and indeed a sense of obligation, has been the political parties of the far right in Europe, who have immediately seized upon this to sound warnings about how, for example, here's a quote, "A welcoming culture is an expression of naive and illusory thinking." This is a spokesperson for Alpha, who's an opposition party in Germany. You've got in France, the far-right National Front leader Marine Le Pen saying, "Germany has a heavy responsibility for inciting at the level of the European Union a passive acceptance of this crisis. Germany's probably thinking about its declining demography. It's probably looking to lower salaries again and recruit slaves through mass immigration." In Australia, we've had an ongoing debate about whether or not we should be accepting Christians first. Now we're accepting persecuted minorities. I'm not exactly sure where that leaves the persecuted majorities of the Middle East in the form of Sunnis who are being persecuted by the Assad regime. You've had a Christians first policy suggested in France as well by local mayors. This is now the undercurrent. So what do you think happens from here, Scott? Where are we in 5 years, 10 years, when these people stop being refugees and they start being people who, I don't know, won't learn the language or won't integrate?
Yeah, well, at the risk of getting prematurely historical on you, Waleed, I do think history here is actually a little bit instructive. I mean, one of the things that I suppose I keep coming back to is some of the serious debates that were being had immediately following the Second World War. I mean, one of the few people that raised real, and I would say kind of deeply principled humanitarian concern about the way in which the newly adopted human rights language as a kind of covering umbrella for those newly stateless people. You know, rights, the regime of human rights were supposed to guarantee people protections even when individual nations could not. It was supposed to be a kind of, you know, bank deposit, if I can put it that way, or a bank deposit guarantee. But it was someone like Simone Weil, for instance, in 1943, very early on, who said that human rights was nowhere near a thick enough form of political and moral protection to provide an adequate safety net, an adequate home for the sheer tonnage of humanity that was being displaced. And I'll confess, Willie, that, you know, as we saw these similar pictures, this sheer tonnage of humanity over this past week. You know, one of the first things that came to mind, and look, I'm an anti-cynical person. As a principled position, I reject cynicism. I cannot help but be heartened by the kind of hopefulness, the idealism, the effervescence of compassion that we've seen. But I suppose one of my great concerns is even a couple months ago, we couldn't have imagined this outpouring of welcome. And so now, is it possible, and I would suggest that it very much is, that in the absence of some more serious debate about what civic capabilities, what national capabilities, not just at the level of technology and social services and language learning, but at the very basic level of the recognition of the presence and the humanities and the place of others within these new communities, once this kind of this layer of sentiment, this layer of compassion begins to evaporate, that it may well be that exactly the sort of social disturbance, the lack of cohesion, as you've rightly pointed out, the kind of bubbling up of this primal nationalism, these primal forms of identification with place and with nation, that these may well be the seeds in the ground of a great deal of social incohesion and unrest for the years to come.
So there cannot be comprehensive solidarity amongst human beings. As Ulrich Beck, possibly my favourite sociologist in this area,
is
my favourite
right?
line
I
from a sociologist.
That, you know? Okay, interesting.
Yeah, well, in this sort of area, and he just has this wonderful line, if you want to create world peace, declare war on Mars. If you can't declare war on Mars, then there is division amongst human beings. This is kind of the way that we operate. So we can't have comprehensive solidarity within our current social and political structures. Or can we? I suppose that is now the most urgent question that is being urged upon us. Because already, the mere fact of people trying to pass the difference between the refugees that are coming in along sectarian grounds, for example. Now, on one level, there's an immediate repellent nature to that. There's a repugnance that you might have in hearing that. But what I think it signals is that already we are seeing these as more than just people who are empty vessels as carriers of human rights. They're not mere carriers of human rights that are otherwise just empty categories. They are people who come coloured with certain religious commitments, certain identity markers, and we will relate to them differently, whether we do that at the level of official policy or not. And I think there is reason to be concerned here, Scott. And to me, one of the evidences of that, is that this was triggered largely by a photograph. Now, I can excuse the public. I can excuse the public for being moved by a photograph, having something that they weren't really fully aware of brought vividly into their vision. I can understand that. It concerns me a little more, though, when the people who are setting public policy and helping form public culture, who must surely have been across the scale of this crisis for many, many months, were not so moved until the photograph emerged. Doesn't that suggest that there is a weakness in our institutions, in our public narrative, in the way that we go about policy formation and responding to these crises, that there is some weakness and that in the fullness of time, that weakness can only come to express itself?
Okay. Look, our very first program, I'm not sure if you remember this, our very first program was about the ethical status of images.
Yes.
Just how robust can they in fact be? Waleed, I had a slightly different... Look, I've got certain moral problems with, okay, how can the knowledge of this ongoing catastrophe that's been rolling there for now 5 years, how could that not have moved us? I do have, over the last few days, I suppose, I've come to cultivate a slightly different take on that particular image. The thing that I keep hearing again and again and again was, oh my God, that could have been my little boy. Look at his little strap-on Velcro shoes. That could have been my son. In other words, what appealed wasn't the difference, but the similarity. And I think that, if I can just go from the purely sentimental right to the hardcore kind of theoretical, that I think, and I'm really interested in your take on this, that gets to the heart of the paradox of modern political identity. When nations stopped being the primary The primary bearer, if you like, of political identity. When that shifted to more of a sense of popular sovereignty, in other words, it's not the territory in which we live, but it's our identification as we the people, to coin a phrase. In other words, when it's we the people that defines who we are and not necessarily where we are, then the real question becomes, well, who counts as among the we? Who is it that's represented by this government? Who is it that's protected by our laws and by our rights? Who is it that has access to our social services and our social safety nets? In other words, when the key issue for any nation doesn't become, okay, you know, what are we pursuing, or what forms of cooperation are we capable in engaging in, or what future are we moving towards, but rather, who is it that counts among the we, then it means that we cannot help but have that kind of skewed interest towards sameness. And that ends up, and this is one of the great paradoxes. I mean, I'm just thinking about the research of people like Jeff Alexander and Charles Taylor and Michael Mann, that in many ways, the paradox of this we the people has ended up producing some extraordinary forms of social brutality, social extrusion, and then even forms of genocide over the last century. What do you think about that, Waleed? Am I sort of pulling a bit of a long bow there?
No, I mean, Michael Mann's argument about democracy is, I think, in the end, a powerful one, that if you have moderate levels of diversity where people can be grouped into certain ethnic markers and you have democracy, then you end up with ethnic cleansing because it becomes effectively a demographic numbers game.
Yes.
And we've seen that happen over and over. I think in hyper-diverse societies, that is less of a concern because the numbers game doesn't work so neatly. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but don't you think that there's a difference, for instance, between civic capability, I mean, the capacity of people to be able to regard one another, to recognize one another, to work together civilly and peacefully. There's a difference between civic capability, which is at the heart of multicultural coexistence, versus, you know, this insistence that for people to belong to the we, they need to sign up to all of our, you know, all of the touchstones of national identity, which invariably become overly symbolic, in some respects, even hackneyed and jingoistic.
Yeah, I think that is a fundamental critique of the age and of nationalism in the age of globalization. And we've spoken about this before. I don't want to labour the point where as the richness of nationalism has kind of been hollowed out, it's been replaced by just a symbolic language and people have to somehow attach themselves to that symbolic language, even as it gets more visceral and louder. We have to attach ourselves to that symbolic language in order for us to feel the necessary cohesion that we will admit certain people into the collective we and thereby extend solidarity to them. And that solidarity is going to be crucial in having cohesion that lasts beyond this particular inspiring moment. Yeah. There are lots of questions that raises about the nation state as a political organisation generally, and then the specific nation states that are here. I don't want to let Australia off the hook. We'll, if we can, get Australia into the conversation, but the immediate focus must surely be Europe. And the question, I suppose, that's raised that we'll look to next is, does Europe and do the nations of Europe, and then by extension Australia and other nations around the world, do they have the socio-political technology, the theory of solidarity that is strong enough and vast enough to deal with this kind of demographic influx by whatever means? And that, I think, is going to be the crucial question that determines the future of these nations and the future of these refugees. We'll try our best to try to solve that next. You are in the minefield. You can leave a comment on our website, by the way. Search for R in the Minefield or tweet us at R in the Minefield.
What is the best way for the European Union to deal with this enormous influx of people?
Well, I think they're starting to do it now, and that is to make provisions to receive them into countries as Germany has so impressively done, welcoming hundreds of thousands of refugees, setting up programs that will help them in the short term get through literally the survival phase of this movement, and then ultimately to help them integrate into the new societies of which they're members. It requires everything from helping teach the language of the country to an awareness of the rules, the laws, the social practices, to the basic services that are available to refugees and new immigrants and so on.
That's former U.S. Army Chief David Petraeus speaking with Lee Sales earlier this week and highlighting, I think, some of the very practical challenges that face refugees flowing into Germany. Our guest today is Professor of Politics at the University of Sydney, John Keane. Now, John, you've heard David Petraeus's quite practical, I'd even almost say technocratic description of the kinds of civil and social services that refugees will need to have access to in order to go from, you know, the first stage, which is survival, to the second stage, which is settlement. The thing that I can't help but wonder, though, is that all that's required here? Is it just language learning services? And is it just the, you know, the kind of the bare bones of how to help people settle in and find jobs? Is there something thicker and deeper that we need?
I think we should go back to basics. What Europe is witnessing, it's the heartland of this global refugee crisis. What Europe is facing is an influx of people who are afraid, desperate, raped, displaced, snipered, homeless, barrel bombed, homes destroyed, families wrecked, on a scale never seen since the 1940s. And for the moment, what we're witnessing, as both of you have said, is a resurgence of, let's call it, the hospitality ethic. Mm. You know, think of the Statue of Liberty. I think it goes something like, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempest, tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Europe, from the 1940s, readjusted borders. And what we're witnessing is a crisis of the arrangements that are commonly called the Dublin Regulation. Mm. So basically, Europe is a space that includes now 26 states where you don't need a passport to move around. And so these people who are escaping war zones and famine and so on are trying desperately to get inside this zone because then they can move freely. Under the Dublin Regulation, it's a bit technical, but it's important, signed in 1990 and now broken. The deal was meant to be, once you get to a state inside that border, then that state is obliged to take care of you, to shelter you, to protect you from the misery you've suffered. That clearly cannot work. It's not working. And so what we're witnessing in Europe at the moment is a crisis of that Dublin Regulation, and everybody watches for the European Commission, the European-level institutions, to agree to something like a German model of how you absorb large numbers of refugees and you house them and you integrate them in society. So far, there is no agreement. The scale is enormous of the problem. I mean, it will probably be nearly a million people will arrive in Germany alone in 2015 and certainly much larger numbers throughout the rest of the Union. So The question, I think, is, as you put it, is that Europe now is faced with, at the top level, agreeing an allocation system of these large numbers of people seeking asylum, and at the lower level, integrating them into society. I would say that the German model, despite all of its weaknesses, it's called the Königsteiner model, is that when people arrive inside of Germany, they're systematically given food, shelter, medical screening. A quota system then kicks in which you are allocated in families wherever possible to cities, and for 6 months you're expected to stay there, and then you can move freely within that. The question is whether that can be replicated on a large scale. I'd say one other thing. I've gone on too long. I would say that cities, European cities, should be included in this discussion because they are laboratories where really interesting things are going on. Marseille, Berlin,
yes,
where people come who flee, you know, fear and desperation and rape and murder and barrel bombing, and are integrated through the civil society, more or less, and where there are groups that actually protect them. For instance, the Center for Political Beauty in Berlin is a group that I know about that specializes in hospitality, in implementing the hospitality ethic. And it's what's really interesting about these cities is that they change the meaning of citizenship. So you become a citizen of that city, You don't necessarily need a passport or states to sanction it. And as a citizen, you are connected to your homeland. You know, you have, it's a refuge where you are safe and you are clothed and you find work and you fall in love and you have children through time, you learn languages, but you also keep in contact with the zones from which you have fled. That's, I think, an entirely new ultra-modern 21st century redefinition of what citizenship and the hospitality ethic implies in practice. It's not
easy. But it's a big redefinition. Yes. Such a big redefinition that it could only happen over a very long period of time. In the meantime, all of these cities still exist within nations that have national TV programs, a national discourse, national leaders.
Yes.
And it might be one thing to have solidarity to a city, but if you feel excluded from the nation, that won't necessarily get you terribly far. So
except that Europe has actually scrambled territorial sovereignty in the last 40 years. And it's true, it's under tremendous pressure at the moment. But the scale of the movement of peoples, unprecedented since the 40s, is so large that no single state can handle this. And so what many millions of Europeans hope and expect is that a new arrangement is put in place where a further erosion of territorial sovereignty becomes necessary, and it is welcomed as a good thing. There are, by the way, some very solid economic reasons for absorbing peoples on this scale. I think this crisis probably signals the end of austerity in at least some of the member states. You cannot absorb peoples on this scale without social spending.
And I think that just exacerbate the problem? This is what I'm getting to.
No, because economically, the economists would point out that this is a chance to actually kickstart growth in Europe. It's been stagnant for 7 years.
But economic narratives rely on social narratives. If I'm going to, I mean, what is an economy? An economy relies on the solidarity between people in it. When I pay taxes, I want to have some solidarity of the people who are going to receive that. I'm not sure we can get around the question. Already you've seen the EU and the idea of integration within Europe cause a populist backlash against that, back onto sort of nationalist categories. Why would it not be even more severe in the case of people coming in this number from Syria?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Waleed, to be utterly realistic about this. After 5 or 6 years of the xenophobic narrative, I think what we're witnessing is the resurgence of that hospitality ethic. And I think that hospitality ethic is being fueled among millions of Europeans, as I read the situation, by a sense of the hypocrisy of this situation. We haven't mentioned it so far. What is the hypocrisy? Some states invade Iraq and Afghanistan, they bomb the hell out of Syria, and then they refuse entry to its fleeing victims. You know, and Australia is caught up in this dynamic. So how to deal with that sense of hypocrisy, that sense of shame? And I think that the solution in the European case, and it probably has to be, it has to become global, is a kind of German model writ large, where states actually agree amicably to solve this problem, and where the civil society is encouraged to kick in with hospitality and openness and so on. What is the alternative? To build what? A barbed wire fence around the whole belt of the Mediterranean. I mean, it's in architectural terms, not possible.
Yeah, John and Willie, let's get down a little bit more local here, and I'll try to phrase this as quickly as I can. I mean, Pierre Manon, who's quite a crucial social critic, has influenced me quite a lot. Yes. He's been talking about, you know, okay, you've got the erosion of national borders. John, you talked about the scrambling of European identity. What this has given rise to, though, is what Manon calls a kind of territorial unconscious. I mean, that's another way of saying far-right parties. John, do you think that this civic hospitality you're talking about, is this enough to counter something quite so primal as this sort of territorial unconscious?
Politics will decide.
Right.
This is uncharacteristically short. uncharacteristically short sentence, but I mean by that that all the momentum has been moving towards strengthening of territorial boundaries in Europe. It's happening in Australia, a kind of lockout mindset, keep them out. The scale of movement of peoples fleeing from zones of desperation is such that this is no longer sustainable. Mm-hmm. And the alternative must be, politically, a revival of the hospitality ethic and a new agreement, certainly beginning in Europe, but at the wider global level, of allocation of peoples so that they can live their lives without fear and violence and rape and murder.
John Keane is a professor of politics at the University of Sydney, so he'll no doubt sort out that political problem. He's been our guest on The Minefield. John, thank you so much for dropping by again.
My pleasure.
Yes, you can visit us on our website. Please leave a comment. I'm sure we've said something today to get your blood rushing. You can also follow us on Twitter at RNTheMinefield.
Look forward to hearing from you and your various correspondents. We will be back next week with another thorny issue. See you then.
Handwriting, according to some, is an anachronism. Finland has now dropped it from its national curriculum. And so many American states have also removed it as an educational requirement that it now only makes news when state officials opt to keep it. The case for and against the retention of handwriting. That's Future Tense. Download the program from the RN website, find us via the ABC Radio app, or look for us on iTunes.